Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts were culled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This is the last podcast culled from the sessions held during the 2019 conference. The session was called A French Affair, in conversation with Kate Forsyth and Natasha Lesser. The allure of France has often inspired historical novelists to conjure the romance of its history. Kate Forsyth's latest novel, The Blue Rose, transports the reader to the perils of the French Revolution and the exotic world of Imperial China. Natasha Lester's The French Photographer deals with the more recent history of World War II France and America. Jackie Ballantyne discusses why Kate and Natasha were drawn to set their books in France and how they discovered new stories to tell about a country that continues to fascinate.
Today we're going to talk about why French, France, Paris on the cover of a book series. Outside, I just did a quick count, and there are five books out there that actually have the word Paris on it, or France. If you spread the culture to include things French, there are probably 200 books, because probably 160 of them have Jackie French on them. Okay, so what I'd like to explore with these two writers today is why the writing something set in France sells. How many people here like reading novels set in France? Why? If I said, how many of you here like novel set in Paris, does it change? How many like novel set? More people like it set in Paris. So the question today is, why is that? Why do we have this hankering for things French? And where does it come from? It's not something that's just emerged. There's a huge literature, as I'm sure you're all aware, set in France. So let's find out what happens and why it's so.
We have the answer to that question, though.
Well, I think at the outset, we might start by saying, why do you two, who both have written novels set in France, Natasha, more than one, and
I've got two.
Two, yeah. Yes. And the other one is the Blue Rose.
And Bitter Greens.
Yes. So, between you, why set your stories in France?
Well, for me, it wasn't actually a deliberate thing to do. So my first book that's set in France is The Paris Seamstress, which came out in 2018. And that was simply because the idea that I had for that book happened to need to take place in Paris. I was struggling to find an idea for that book and took a long time to come. And I happened to be listening to a podcast, which is was a New York history podcast, in fact, called The Bowery Boys. And they had an episode on the fashion history of Manhattan. And one very small part of that podcast was about the birth of the ready-to-wear industry in New York during the 1940s, because, of course, prior to that, Paris had been the centre of fashion. But then when the Nazis occupied Paris during the Second World War, they closed off the Paris fashion industry to the rest of the world. So the rest of the world suddenly had to find its fashion feet, and Manhattan was really the first place to do that. And so ready-to-wear kind of blossomed into a sportswear, as it was called back then, in New York. And so I just thought, gosh, that's so fascinating. I wanted to write about the evolution of sportswear or prêt-à-porter or ready-to-wear. And so, which meant there was this kind of French connection there, because I needed to set the groundwork of it having been previously a very Parisian fashion industry. So I came up with this idea of this Paris seamstress who would start in Paris and then move to New York during the war. So it was really, for that one, simply the idea that drove that book. And when I said to my publisher, oh, I I'm writing this, what do you think, is it a good idea? She's like, oh my goodness, the word Paris in a title always makes a book sell. And I was like, oh really? I had no idea, I was so naive, which is probably a good thing. So that was really why I wrote that book. And same thing with the French photographer, I wanted to write a story about a character inspired by Lee Miller. And so a large part of that book was set in France, and I'm actually really bad at titles. My first two books, my publisher changed the title. She didn't for the Paris seamstress, and then with the French photographer again, it was just, that was the right title for the book, and so that one got through. And so again, it was really idea-driven rather than it being, I want to write a book set in France. I don't know, is that how it was for you?
It's very different for me. So firstly, I am one of those people that will always buy a book that's got Paris in the title. When I was a little girl, my grandmother was the most wonderful storyteller, and she told us that we were descended from a Norman knight who had fought at the side of William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings and had then settled in England. Now, the Battle of Hastings was almost exactly 900 years before I was born, but I thought that surely gave me a drop of French blood. And so I've always used my drop of French blood to explain my love of clothes, expensive perfume, champagne, cooking and gardens. And whenever my husband complains that I've spent too much money on shoes, I go, oh, darling, I can't help it. I've got a drop of French blood. You know that. So I was always drawn to... to France and the idea of Paris. My life plan was to finish school, move to Paris, live on the left bank, wear a velvet beret and write poetry while sipping absinthe. And then I met a gorgeous young man, fell in love, and I've never left Sydney. So to me, France was always this place of high romance and beauty and fine living and... besides, who doesn't love a man with a French accent? Now, for me, I'm just the same as Natasha, though. I never said, I am going to set a book in France. What story can I tell? My first book that is set, about a third to a half of it is set in France, was Bitter Greens. I set out to write a surprising retelling of a Rapunzel as a historical novel. I knew that I wanted to structure the book, to have its thematic structure inspired by the most memorable motif in the fairy tale, which is the plait of three hairs. So I knew I was going to tell one part from the maiden in the tower, one part from the witch, but I needed a third narrative thread. It would have been obvious to have used the mother, but I wanted to do something that wasn't obvious. So I thought, I wonder who first told the tale. And she just happened to be a French noblewoman at the court of Louis XIV, the Sun King. And as soon as I realised that this young French woman had written the fairy tale we now know of as Rapunzel while locked up in a convent for her wild and wicked ways, well, I knew I had to write her story. And she just ran away with the book. So the story provided the setting, not the setting, the story. Mm. Mm-hmm. And it was the same with the Blue Rose. Mm-hmm. I'm always drawn to the story, and then it just happens to be set somewhere fabulous.
Mm. I suppose I did leave a bit of my French kind of connections out of my little recount there, because also, like you, I'm completely obsessed with France and Paris. I think you have to be to write books set there. I mean, I studied French all through high school and was lucky enough to land a job with L'Oréal, French company, in Melbourne, working as their marketing manager for the Maybelline brand. I had a ton of lipsticks, like more than you could wear for an entire lifetime, and for their Garnier skin and body care products. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, while I was working for them, I spoke fluent French. I'm no longer fluent. I'm still not. I can read very well and converse very well, but I'm not fluent. So I've always had that love of the French language, mm-hmm. and love of France, and yes, love of a man with a French accent.
Yeah.
Wow. You've actually both preempted the next question, but that's okay. When I first knew that I was going to be talking about the French Affair, I thought, I'll go through my books and pull out anything that has Paris or France on it. And I realised I had, like, this many books.
Yeah.
So, like you, I've always been drawn to books set in that area. Era or area.
Mm.
And I'm not sure why. I have no drop of French blood. I'm Aussie through and through. I do have, we have very similar histories, Natasha and I, a generation apart, but fairly similar. I came through the fashion industry and learned to love all things French there. Mm. Probably my French perfume I will never give up when I'm an old lady, even older, in an institution. David will still be bringing me.
So what's your French perfume that you wear?
It's Samsara Guerlain.
Mm. Mine is Joy.
That's tattoo.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes. So, so for whatever reason, we are all sucked into the French narrative. Mm. I want to read a quote to you both. You have both answered the first, to some extent, the first part of this. There's a historian called Graham Robb who writes really accessible French history, and he wrote a book called Parisians, An Adventure History of Paris. And in it he said this quote, narrative devices and perspectives that he used were naturally suggested by a place, a historical movement, or a personality. Now, you've just said yours was a personality, mm-hmm. and we'll come back to that in a minute. Yours was the story of a rose.
Oh, yes.
Perhaps you'd like to tell the story that led to the writing of this book.
So, my love of all things French is married to my love of roses, which are my favourite flower. And so I have vast libraries of books about French history and vast library about books about the history and meaning and symbology of roses. And I was once reading a book called Chasing the Rose, which is a history of one particular rose. And I read a passage that in 1792, a British nurseryman called Gilbert Slater brought back at enormous expense and danger and difficulty, brought back from China a blood-red rose that was called the ever-blowing rose of China. It's called that because it blooms again and again and again, will bloom even in frost and sometimes even in snow. At that time, in the 18th century, Western roses bloomed only once in springtime, and then it was just an ugly, thorny shrub for the rest of the year. Now, even though a British merchant brought back this fabled rose of China, which was blood red, it was hybridized in France, and it is the ancestor of all red roses that we have today. Now, my first thought was, surely this is not true, surely there were red roses in Europe before 1792. And my second thought was, 1792, that was right at the beginning of the French Revolution, and that was when France and Britain were at war. How did a rose originating in China be brought back to Britain and end up in France? And that really fascinated me, and so I set out on this journey of discovery, which involved a lot of reading in the China archives at the British Library, and I discovered this untold story, this quest for this incredibly beautiful and incredibly symbolically rich rose, and the fortunes that were spent in trying to gain it, and the problems that were had in hybridizing it. And what I discovered is it is actually true that this, when we think of a red rose, we think of a rose of this color, but roses in Europe at that time were more of a crimson, even a magenta. It's just that blood red color was so rare.
Mm. But before we leave roses, I remember reading a book when I was in the 70s, maybe early 70s, maybe even 60s, called For the Love of a Rose.
I've read that as well.
Story of the Peace Rose. Yeah. And that has never left me. I think the story of roses are probably a bit like the stories of Paris, full of romance.
Full of romance, but also, you know, a rose is a symbol not just of passion, but also of pain, and not just of life, but also of death, and not just of connection, but also of secrecy. And so because they have this paradoxical, you know, symbology, that makes them really, really interesting to use.
Mm. Okay, so Beginning with a Rose, a wonderful book. Beginning with
a photographer.
The French photographer.
Yes.
begins with?
So what inspired this book was when I was researching the Paris seamstress, I came across the story of Lee Miller, who I had never heard of before, and her story was quite fascinating. So Lee started out life as a model for Vogue in New York, so she was an American. She was a very famous model throughout the 1920s and had this amazing modelling career, beautiful woman. You should go and look at photographs of her on the internet because it's full of photographs of Lee Miller. And then something happened which cut her modelling career off short. An image of her was used without her knowledge and without her consent in an advertisement for Kotex sanitary products. And it's very hard for us to understand how that could possibly end someone's career. But back in the 1920s, menstruation was like the eighth deadly sin. You were not allowed to admit that you did it, even if you're a woman, which is kind of tricky. But and certainly you weren't allowed to have your image featured in an advertisement for those products. So Lee became known as the Kotex girl, and Vogue decided it couldn't have the Kotex girl on the cover of the magazine because their advertisers would leave in droves. So Lee's modelling career was over, so she decided to do what you do when your modelling career ends. She moved to Paris, of course. And there she met photographer Man Ray, and of course she became Man Ray's lover again, as you do when you're in Paris. But more importantly than that, Man taught her photography. And so she became quite a well-regarded surrealist photographer in Paris throughout the 1930s. And then with the advent of the Second World War, she kind of changed direction and changed careers again. And she was accredited as Vogue's photojournalist following the armies of the Second World War throughout Europe. And she took some amazing shots. Again, go and have a look at the internet. It's awash with photos. Normally, I do this presentation with a slideshow. So she witnessed lots of things. She witnessed the US Army's first use of napalm in Saint-Malo. She was one of the first at the concentration camps, which was obviously a really tough experience for her as a photographer because she had to witness and record everything that she saw there. There's also a very iconic photograph of Lee in Adolf Hitler's bathtub in his apartment in Munich, which is a shot that she set up. She travelled through Europe with David Sherman, who was a life journalist, and they were kind of lovers, again, as you do when you're travelling through Europe. And so she set up this shot in Hitler's bathtub with a photograph of Hitler propped up on the edge of the bathtub, and she's sitting in the bath, and you can only see, like, from shoulders up. And she's filthy because she's been driving through Europe for the last year through mud and dust and bombed out cities. And Hitler's bathroom is pristine white. It's so clean, she can't believe a room in wartime could possibly be so clean. And she was already very angry because she'd just come from the concentration camps. And to walk into his bathroom and see that he'd been having someone, you know, spend time cleaning his bathroom to that high state whilst people were dying, just outraged her, as you can imagine. So she sat in the tub and got David to take this shot of her that she'd set up with the filth of Dachau running off her and her big cloddish paratrooper boots dropping the dirt of Dachau as she sat onto Hitler's previously pristine bath mat. So she did some really quite incredible things, and that photo is very iconic. But then after the war, she was so traumatised by everything that she had seen, she decided to forget, basically, that she had ever had this role as a photojournalist. And so effective was she at kind of erasing that part of her life from her life that her son didn't actually know she had done that during the war until after she died. And he found her archive hidden in her attic, 60,000 pieces of wartime paraphernalia, her letters to her editor, her drafts of her articles, her negatives, her films, her prints, everything. And he realised that, you know, he had stumbled upon something quite extraordinary because he remembered his mother as being really an alcoholic who was very depressed and hadn't seen that there was this other side to her. So he was responsible, I guess, for resurrecting Lee. Now she's widely regarded as one of the war's preeminent photojournalists. Not many people know about that history of her and, you know, what a story was behind her life. So I wanted to write about that, someone who might have been, as a woman, as so many women were at that time, forgotten by history, even though what they did during wartime was actually something that should have been remembered. So that was really what inspired the story of the French photographer, that and the kind of the work of the female photojournalists and the female correspondents, because they had a very tough time.
Terrific. Can I just borrow this
you
for
can.
A minute? As well as everybody in here loving things set in Paris and France, David and I came up on the train from Melbourne. And I was actually reading this at the time, and I had it open, And another passenger stopped and said, "Oh, I loved that book," and then stood talking to me for about 40 minutes about this and the Paris seamstress. And I told her I was coming to meet you, and she was very, very excited that by some transference so was she. But it didn't end there, because when you're reading books on a train that people recognise, they stop and talk. So the next person had read this. And so can I suggest as a marketing tool, the next time you publish a book with a Paris content, sit on the train and read it openly, and you'll discover your readers.
Bryce Courtney, whenever he had a new book out, he would pay university students to travel around cities on public transport reading his book like this, you know, I was a university student at the time.
Oh, did you do it?
I didn't do it, but I should have done it.
You should have done it. Should have done it. I have to say I have left books in my own books, really crappy, isn't it, in airports and bus shelters and things, and I still slot them sometimes into free libraries in shopping centres.
No, you should.
Anywhere to get read.
Yeah.
Can I go back, if you don't mind, to this quote of Graham Robb's? Because he goes on to say that each tale of his was written with a flavour of the time in mind. It demanded its own explanations and imposed its own forms of courtesy to the past. I'm interested in this, and I'm interested in the way each of you approached doing that, getting the flavour of the time, the explanations imposed by those times, and at the same time giving a courtesy to the past. And I have to say that I have read both these books, and that certainly is evident in the writing of the books. But how did you go about that? Perhaps.
Well, I think that's the art of the novelist, isn't it? So it's our job to tell a story and to make that story, you know, to offer this kind of deep immersive reading experience to our readers, to bring the world of the past so vividly to life that the reader feels as if they've been there, they can smell it, they can taste it, they can feel it on their skin. It's our job to make the people who once lived come to life again. It's this kind of, we travel to the underworld and we bring back ghosts and give them life again. So how do we do it? I think it really helps to fully immerse yourself in the time. I call it, it's kind of like a method writing. So when I'm writing a book, I'm cooking the food that they would eat. I begin to wear the clothes they might have worn. I love to have actually artifacts that I can hold in my hand that gives me some kind of psychic resonance with the past. I read everything that I can find. So I read both primary and secondary sources. I read the work of historians. I read the work of other novelists. I read the work of people who were writing at that time. And I read the work of other creative artists. And not just the work, the music, the art, the fashion, the everything, until I feel like I've been there, and then I do my best to make it dance on the page.
I spent years, certainly through high school, I studied French history and then went on to study the French Revolution. And if I had had this book back in matric in all those years ago, I'm sure I would have done better in the end of year exams. I got by, but this is just so alive. And we are on the streets. We are on the streets among the people of Paris. And I think that's even more of an art form. I think it is the immersion and you just being there. Extraordinary. Really, really.
Well, good. Vladimir Nabokov said that an author needs to be a storyteller, a teacher, and an enchanter. And I really, really agree with that. I think that's our three jobs. So the story has to be paramount, that everything is in service to the story. But you do want your readers to grow and learn, but you want them to learn without them realising it, because it's not a lesson, it's a story. But by the end of the book, they should have learned so much they didn't know before, and they should be able to talk about it with, conviction and passion. And hopefully at the end of a great book, you're driven, like I was driven when I finished The French Photographer, to go and look at the photographs and to read more about it and to keep on discovering. Mm. It alights curiosity in you. And finally, of course, it is an act of enchantment. It's our job to enchant the reader and to cast a spell on them that they never truly wake from. Mm.
In the French Photographer, you obviously immersed yourself as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And I love it that the character in this book wears dresses designed by the Paris seamstress.
Yeah, I love that as well.
Sometimes if you look very carefully, authors do these lovely little, almost author-to-author...
Not sometimes, we do it all the time, don't we?
We do it all the time. Okay, they do it all the time.
Yeah, just most people don't notice.
No. I do love that that she wears stellar designs. Mm. So, yes, with the peony on.
Yes.
Tell us about...
So similar to Kate, although one thing, I didn't actually immerse myself in the food from the time because ration boxes didn't sound particularly appealing, so I gave that a miss. But very similar to Kate, so much reading. I mean, I could probably, hand on heart, say I've read almost every single article written during the Second World War by all the correspondents, particularly because my book is about the experience of the female correspondents. So their work was primary to me, but then I also wanted to see how it differed from what the male correspondents wrote too, because that was kind of important, because there are some quite stark differences in the way they reported and what the things that they saw. So I read a lot of articles from newspapers and magazines and journals and things like that, looked at lots of photographs. I went to France, which is, a terrible job to have to do when you're writing a book set in France. So my husband jokes that I choose places to set my books in based on where I want to travel to next, and I always say, well, why wouldn't you if you had a choice? So we went... The contemporary storyline of the novel is set in a French chateau, so we had to, for authenticity's sake, stay in a French chateau for a few days, which was gorgeous, and the chateau in the book is based on a particular chateau in the Champagne region in France, which was a beautiful spot. But then I went up to Normandy and went to all the different museums there and went to Omaha Beach. And I think that was a particularly memorable experience because by the time I got to Omaha Beach, I had done so much reading of all the correspondence articles about Omaha Beach and D-Day and the days subsequent to D-Day. And so I had what I would call an intellectual understanding of what Omaha Beach would look like. I knew that it was a very wide beach. I knew how it was situated with the cliffs up top. I'd seen photographs of the old cemetery and the new cemetery. But it's not until you're standing on Omaha Beach that you realise how wide that beach actually really is and what that would mean. And you feel, as you're standing there, you imagine the soldiers coming in on the boats and them seeing how wide the beach is and realising that they have to get across that beach whilst the Germans are shooting down at them from the cliff tops. And, so they get out of the boat and they're in the water, and if they're lucky enough to get to the start of the shoreline, they've got to make it to the other side. Then if they do that, they've got to somehow make it to the top of the cliffs. And when you're standing on the beach, you go, actually, that's impossible. There's no way anyone could have done that because there's so much beach and it's so exposed and the cliffs are so high and it's such a, great vantage point for the German infantry that was atop the cliffs. But obviously they did do it. If they hadn't have done it, history would have been a very different thing. And so standing on the beach, I got an emotional understanding, I guess you would say, rather than just an intellectual understanding of that. I think that's really important. When you're writing, particularly things set around sensitive issues like war, I think you have to go and make sure you have that emotional understanding so that you are able to convey that properly in the story and in a way that pays homage to the people who did die there, as so many did. But also another very interesting aspect of the research, I guess, was that really getting an authentic view of the experience of those female correspondents and the chauvinism and the discrimination that they faced, which I didn't know going into the book the extent of that. And really, One of the best sources of material for that was the memoir of a man called Colonel Barry Oldfield. He was one of the PROs, or the public relations officers, for the US Army, and he wrote this book about his experiences. So he managed the correspondence, he gave them their assignments and looked after them. And he didn't mean for his book to be this, but it is very accidentally a horrific account of the discrimination against the female correspondents. And he writes about the things that they did to the women with no understanding of how wrong that was, and how, looking back on it now, I had to close this book some time ago. That can't possibly have happened. There's one specific incident where the women weren't allowed to go over to witness D-Day. They weren't allowed to go with the invasion fleet because they were women. All the men were allowed to go, of course. But it was deemed to be unseemly for women to witness such things. And so, but the women obviously fought for the right to do that. And they heard about this parachute training school where they were training male correspondents to jump out of a plane with a parachute so they could parachute some of the male correspondents in, because space on the boats was obviously an issue. So the women said, OK, great, well, why can't we go to parachute training school and learn the same thing, and then we could go across in the planes and jump out and get our story that way. And he writes in his memoir that he hunted high and low for someone to come up with a reason why the women couldn't do that. And he found a major in the Surgeon General's office who gave him exactly what he wanted, which was this letter saying that he wouldn't like to think about what effect jumping out of a plane, going that fast with a and the opening thrust of the parachute canopy, what that would do to the delicate female apparatus. And that is a verbatim quote. I did not make that up. You can't make this stuff up. It's not possible. And so when I read that, I thought, my God, imagine being Martha Gellhorn, who's covered the Spanish Civil War as one of the most experienced war correspondents there, and being told you can't go to parachute training school because of your delicate vagina. Clearly the man has never witnessed childbirth, obviously.
You know, obviously the type of books that we write are so research intensive, and the research often gives us our story. So for me, and I know that we obviously work in different ways, but for me, I start by just reading as much as I can, learning all that I can, beginning to build my timelines, beginning to find out what I need to tell this story. I'm often coming from a place of quite little knowledge. I've been fascinated by the French Revolution all of my life, and I read a lot about it, but I still didn't truly understand it. And so as I'm researching and reading, I'm building up my own knowledge, and I'm beginning to find things that I think I can use as part of my story, building timelines. I don't start writing until I've got a really strong sense of my story, but then, often the research takes almost as long as the actual writing does. Then while I'm writing, I discover all sorts of things that I don't know. The story throws up questions to me. So what I do is, as I'm writing a scene and I realise I don't know something I should know, I make a note of it, and then I keep on writing, because research can just suck you down this dark hole. And my writing time is really, really precious. I'm a mother with three children. I can research in the cracks of the day. I can research on my iPad while I'm making dinner. But it's much harder to write a whole scene while I'm doing that. And so each night at the end of the day, I actually find I have a whole list of questions that I have to answer. And I set about answering those. But I keep pushing my story forward. And I keep going. And as I come to a scene that by the time I'm writing it, I'd planned it a year earlier, I've got to go back to my research books and re-immerse myself in my research and find out everything that I need to know to write that scene. So I'm constantly going back to all my research books. And then when the book is finished, it's fact-checking. Mm. And so, you know, I have to go back once again. So the research never ends, but it works in slightly different ways during the writing process. And I find that really deep research at the beginning of the book is a really important part of my creative process, and it often gives me my core story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think I would love to do it the way Kate does that. I do it a little bit differently because, unfortunately, I can't plan a story in advance. I have tried and I wish that I could, and it doesn't work for me like that. So when I'm starting out with my first draft, I actually have to work out what the story is, which means I have to write it to figure that out. So I don't really know what I need to research up front. So other than, I knew obviously I was writing about a female correspondent, so what I do as I'm writing that first draft is I might read a couple of books that cover the topic broadly to give me a broad scope. So one that I read was a book that collected together the experiences of a number of different female correspondents. So I had a kind of a broad brush approach to that. And then that gives me names that I can drill down into to look at specific individuals, etc. So I'm writing my first draft. It's full of holes because I don't know enough. There's got lots of gaps saying you need to research this, you need to research that. And then when that first draft is finished, that acts as my research blueprint, I guess you could say. And so then I research to fill in all the gaps, all the many, many, many gaps that I have in that first draft. And so I spend a full month doing nothing but research at that point. And then as I then redraft, I will continue to read through that whole time because there's always so much reading that you have to be doing. So it's a little bit different just because of the way that my writing process worked. If I planned up front, then I could research up front, but I can't, so I do it the other way around.
Yeah.
I want to just leave you with, actually it's a quote, and it's a quote from Natasha's book, but I think everyone in the room should be thinking about this. Photographs, it's from Walter Lippmann, the columnist, who said, "Photographs have been the kind of authority over imagination today, which the printed word was yesterday and the spoken word before that. They seem utterly real." When you're doing your research, I think you need to bear in mind what photographs tell you and don't tell you.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.